You're listening to a Countout Podcast.
Hey, baseball fans, it's time to swing big on your bets this season. Step up to the plate with an odds boost token from BetMGM, an official sports betting partner of Major League Baseball. No opt-in is required. Just log into your BetMGM account to receive your odds boost token. Then, place a bet on any MLB game and activate your token. If your boosted bet hits, you'll score a bigger payout, no matter the showdown. BetMGM is your betting home for baseball. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. See BetMGM.com for terms. 21 plus only. This U.S. promotion offer not available in Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. For New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369. For Arizona, call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. For Massachusetts, 1-800-327-5050. For Iowa, 1-800-BETS-OFF. For Puerto Rico, 1-800-981-0023. Subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary and expire in 1 to 7 days. In partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And welcome to The Ballot, the podcast where these conversations begin. I'm your host, Ryan Knightsey. Thank you for joining us on this special bonus episode of The Ballot. I hope you enjoyed the last episode regarding Io Shirai, Io Sky, and all the episodes we've had so far. We're doing something a little bit different on this episode because of the passing of Sabu, I wanted to sort of put together a little audio montage, sort of a collage from various past guests, possibly future guests of the Ballot, to discuss Sabu, these various voices' connections to Sabu and what of his Hall of Fame case. Dave Meltzer, obviously of the Wrestling Observer, has talked about how, Sabu's probably going back on the ballot. And that obviously for us here on the ballot is a departure. This podcast is meant to discuss the newcomers, the first time balloteers, which is not a word, I don't think. This is the place where we discuss them for the first time and their Hall of Fame candidacy. Sabu, this is, if he goes back on the ballot, which I think it's safe to presume he will. Dave has done this in the past, where if a wrestler passes away, they'll put him on, especially I think when they have already been on there previously, Dave has put them back on. Sabu is not a newcomer. He is not a newcomer to this Hall of Fame at all. In fact, he's been on it twice already. He was on the Hall of Fame ballot of 2000. But, I think the year 2000 is just a little too close to his sort of peak years of ECW. So he fell off immediately, dropped off at less than 10%. And then he was brought back on in 2005, where he was able to stay on up until 2011, where he dropped off in 10%. His peak at the time was when he first came on in 2005 at 31%. And then as it went on, he kind of went down to 11, then 12, then 18 in 2008. I don't know what that, I imagine, honestly, I was going to say, I don't know what that is. That might just be the John Cena, the ECW run, the WWE ECW stuff. But that would be 18% in 2008, 2009, 2010, both 11%. And then obviously fall off in 2011 with less than 10%. So this would be his third time, but you never know. Third time might be the charm for Sabu here. So I wanted to talk about Sabu, obviously. There's going to be a lot of people to discuss that are going to discuss him and their importance to them and their, his sort of Hall of Fame case. But of course, I wanted to give my own thoughts on him. You know, I didn't do a whole bunch of research beforehand. I didn't do my usual deep dive in the drawing cases. But I wanted to just sort of, you know, think back, you know, sort of make this sort of fairly quickly with a little bit of time, but fairly, you know, just to really just like sort of ruminate and I guess to a certain degree eulogize Sabu. You know, I, based on, you know, if you know my history of watching wrestling, if you've heard it on Ring Post Radio or, you know, heard it on, maybe I've talked about the ballot before. I don't quite remember. You know, I started watching wrestling properly, in 2007, right around the build. I can't quite remember if it was right before or right after the build surrounding WrestleMania 23. And of course, that then becomes the first time I see Sabu is basically, you know, in the WWE.com pictures and online stuff and all these sort of things of what was the ECW, what was their name? Stars? The ECW Faithful? No, whatever their team name was versus the New Breed, right? This is Sabu, this is Sandman, this is Tommy Dreamer, this is RVD. And of course, they're going against the New Breed of Marcus Corvon, Kevin Thorne, who the heck else is on there? Elijah Burke, Matt Stryker. You know, a weird match at that WrestleMania and a weird WrestleMania, I guess, now in 2025. You know, when you see those pictures online, you see Sabu and you're like, what the heck is, who the heck is that guy? That guy's interesting. I mean, I guess I also thought of that about Kevin Thorne to a certain degree, but I think those are for different instances. Sabu, you know, I never really watched a lot of him during that period because I was watching mostly SmackDown at the time for whatever reason. I didn't watch Raw. I didn't watch ECW. And so what required, you know, I guess to a certain degree, I wasn't fully, maybe I wasn't fully drawn into the rest of the WWE product, and I was just drawn to SmackDown, or I only wanted to dip my toe. I don't know what young me was all about, but I do know that, like, a lot of what I had to do when it came to Sabu is watch him later in life as I grew up, because obviously he wasn't much longer lasting in the WWE, in that version of ECW, you know, then eventually going bouncing around with, you know, more indie dates, TNA, Japan. So I never really, I was negative two in his peak of 94, right? So I never saw his peak. I barely even saw him when he was in WWE for whatever reason. But so a lot of what I had to do in regards to Sabu is to go back in time and watch him later. And watching him later is what I certainly did. You know, obviously, I'm not going to say I'm any sort of Sabu expert. I think there are a lot more experts on the man than I. But he was always a fascinating person, you know. He was deafifying, right? I think that is the summation of everything. You know, the suicidal, genocidal, homicidal. You know, he was the epitome of that sort of death match, at least on the American side, style, right? He was a guy, you know, I talked about this on Ring Post Radio, where, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you could say also that he is a, I think when it comes, especially when it comes to his historical significance, which we'll talk about momentarily, he is the sort of, he was the embodiment, I think, of ECW, especially that sort of peak ECW era. To a certain extent, even when a lot of it is the Vox Sabu chants, right? The sort of him leaving ECW high and dry to work New Japan, and, you know, trying to do both for whatever reason. You know, he was a guy that just played by his own rules, and his rules worked. They got him over. The crowd loved him, and wherever he went, he would become this guy to watch. He wouldn't become the top of the card, and I think obviously to a big degree, you know, guys like that, in terms of the death-defying stuntmen more so than anything else, I guess, the barbed wire fire guys, you know, a lot of those guys in any territory are not going to be the top of the pack unless the territory is already, you know, deathmatch leaning. But he was a guy that was always seen as like, what is he doing? You never felt like it was never a show with Sabu. It was always real. That was something that was obviously important of him, whether it be through actual botching or fake botching. It always comes across that, you know, there was a realness to what he was doing. You know, this is going to be a weird tangent, but I've seen a couple. If you've seen a couple circus acts, specifically Cirque du Soleil, the I believe French Canadian circus group, I know of that acts of those acts in the way that, you know, they would do these little bits where they would run on a giant wheel or whatever, and they would showcase them messing up, right? They would run on a giant wheel, and then maybe someone would slip and fall and catch themselves, and the crowd would gasp, oh my God, he almost died. And then the guy would continue the act. That is a botch, but I do know colloquially that is a planned rehearsed botch, is a botch done safely. In a lot of ways. And you could argue Sabu's botches weren't always done safely to a certain degree, but I do know that is part of the circus that is real. And the purpose of that maybe is to cover their ass in case it is ever a real botch, but I do know that the purpose of that is, hey, what we're doing is real. If you don't, it ends up just maybe becoming too overly choreographed, too polished, you know, that not that, you know, the lumps of clay or lumps of gray clay or whatever the quote is from Minoru Suzuki. But you have to remind the audience that it is real. And that is obviously what Sabu was about, was his job was to tell the audience, this is real. I'm not going to be polished. At least my gimmick, you know, he might know some stuff from his training, from his uncle. But the effort into looking crazy is very difficult. It's a very hard line to draw. And I think Sabu nailed it, honestly. I think guys like Abdullah, Brody do that very well. It's a very hard line. I mean, his uncle, the original Sheik, very, you know, it's a very hard line to master. And I think he did really well. You know, you look to the psychology of what he's trying to do and the importance of it, right? You know, when Vince wanted to bring him WWE and have him do a table spot in the Rumble, one of the big reasons Sabu didn't want to do it is because the psychology was wrong. That it was just, I'm just bringing a table just because I'm bringing a table. What's the why? What's the realness? Why would a wrestler do this? You know, some wrestlers, I guess, would do it just to have an extra weapon. And that's fine. You know, you could do that. But to Sabu, it was the only reason I use tables is because, you know, the ring bell, the timekeeper's table is what I'm using and bringing into the ring. You know, I'm not just going to bring a table. There's not going to be tables underneath the ring itself. There has to be an actual psychology. I'm only going to use what is available to me because I'm a crazy wild man that is not thinking ahead of time. Sabu was not methodical in that way. The character Sabu was a wild and crazy man that did not come out with predetermined notions of what was going to happen. That was the character. That was the psychology. And nowadays, that's obviously, I think in a lot of ways, kind of gone to the wayside, which does sort of suck. I mean, you don't have to be a deathmatch dealer like Sabu, but you could certainly be less polished. Remind people that this is real. And I think that realness obviously was maybe part of the issue later in his years as it came down, especially as we get towards his retirement match in GCW against Joey Janela. That realness, that need for reality, I think almost, you know, the line got crossed in a lot of ways there because it became almost too real for a guy like that. And I think that's just the sort of complicated history of Sabu. When it comes to his Hall of Fame case, I think it's very interesting. I think when it comes to work rate, he's obviously not, you know, a bell-to-bell great worker. I don't think anyone would necessarily describe him as that. I would describe him as great at what he does. And if you want to compare him, you know, we can compare him to some 96ers like Abdullah. We can compare him to Onita. I think, you know, he, in terms of the American style, nailed what he attempted to do in a lot of ways. I guess both good and bad, especially during his peak years and stuff. But he nailed what he went out to do. Was it, you know, one of the best workers ever, right? No, but he nailed what his gimmick was. In a lot of ways, that there is something to that. That's why I lean positive on his work rate ability, his working ability. You know, promos were never a part of it. And obviously in his later years when he was forced to cut promos, that sort of became an issue for him. I think I saw a quote saying that one of the reasons he never cut promos was because he was afraid to disappoint his mother, which is a fun little quote there. But, you know, it's not like an all-time Hall of Fame worker. You know, we talked about Io Shirai in the last episode. He's no Io Shirai, he's no Hall of Fame worker, going out there having multiple four-star matches. But what he did definitely drew eyes. It didn't necessarily always draw money, but at least on an indie level, Sabu was a draw, a big-time draw. So much so that a lot of Sabu and that Taz feud in ECW were able to help launch the pay-per-view stuff and build and the desire to see ECW's first pay-per-view. But ultimately, right, he's not a Hall of Fame draw. This is his weakest issue. Scotty brought this up on the last episode with Io Shirai, where he talks about drawing. He goes very broad with his drawing cases in the regards of, do you bring eyes to the product? And which is way more broad than obviously just like, do you bring ticket sales, right? Which is what everyone goes to. I think Sabu is more that case. He's not a ticket sales guy, but he brings eyes to the product. He's not necessarily set in positions to be the top draw. And I don't know if he ever really was the top draw, even in ECW. But he's a guy that's going to bring eyes to your product. And maybe that's part of the issue, right? Is maybe because he never really was the top of the card. You can't really contribute a lot of the success in terms of drawing to him. But he certainly brought eyes to the product. 20 minutes already. Okay, I need to wrap things up. Historical significance. dang. Hard to wrap things up when you have the biggest case for Sabu here in historical significance. He is the guy that popularized, I think, definitely the table spot in America. I think a lot of degree of the American deathmatch style in America as well. So he's a major influence there. You can maybe argue negativity because I hate We Want Tables chants in WWE today and wrestling today, really. And that is related to how popular Sabu got it. I think it's sort of been bastardized in a lot of ways and sort of turned away from Sabu. I think especially it's become Vince McMahon interpreted rather than Sabu psychology interpreted. So maybe there's a blame there for Sabu, but ultimately he is the guy that popularized that spot. You know, if you talk about, you know, the Hardys, they're on this ballot. If you talk about them as, you know, historically significant in terms of broadening the appeal of these ladder matches and TLC matches, I guess you can obviously say ladder matches. But the overall, like, hardcore style, less so the deathmatch style, but the hardcore style really starts with Sabu, which then helps probably inspire the Hardys as well. Hayabusa, we'll bring him up. The clubhouse leader in Japan right now, 53.2% as of last year. The guy that probably is going to be voted in into the Hall of Fame this upcoming ballot, correct? He would say that is crazy because, especially looking at Sabu's case, because Hayabusa would tell you that he was just a sort of, you know, not in terms of the negative sense, but a positive ripoff of Sabu. And what's funny enough is Sabu would agree with you. well, maybe not funny if you know the guy, but Sabu would, I don't know the guy. What am I saying? Sabu would agree with you. Both men would agree that Hayabusa is just a ripoff of Sabu. And we are very close to voting in Hayabusa as a Hall of Famer. If Hayabusa, a guy that is a potential one-to-one ripoff of Sabu, is considered a Hall of Famer, what does that make Sabu? If guys that are like Abdullah or Onita, that Dave in 96 viewed as you know, important figures in wrestling history, what does that say about Sabu? I think he has massive historical significance. There are a lot more people that will probably talk about it, that will certainly talk about it, upcoming on this audio. But it is a massive historical significance case for him. How will he do this year? I think he'll do fairly well. Obviously, there's the death bump and everything there. Will he do better than his 05 appearance at 31%, you know, his highest peak? Maybe, possibly, maybe the death bump will bring him up even more. 31% right now would put him in between the Steiner brothers and Randy Orton. Personally, I would maybe put him above Randy Orton, but I get it that, you know, you're battling the WWE-ness of Randy Orton there. All in all, he's a massive historical significance. He inspired a probable future Hall of Famer this year in Hayabusa, massively inspired. He inspired a lot of indie wrestlers. He promoted and became the trailblazer of the table spot in American wrestling. His working style is pretty good for what it is, but he is a draw. He's a guy that brings eyes to products, not necessarily dollars, but certainly eyes. I think he has a solid enough case. I think the issue is that he has a lot of fringes and all these sort of issues compared to the WWE-ness of modern US and Canada category. We'll see what happens with Sabu. I'm fascinated to see what happens with Sabu. I've talked way too long, and I need to intro all of the great people that have sent in audio discussing Sabu. This is going to be a long episode. Strap in. There's been a lot of great people that sent in audio. I asked them to discuss no more than 10 minutes, and here I am going triple than that. So thank you to everybody. Let's read out and thank some of the names of people that have sent in audio. I want to first thank Adam Berger. He's a VoicesOfWrestling.com contributor, has written many articles, and actually appeared on this show several times already, talking about Bray Wyatt and Drew McIntyre. Not really Hall of Famers. I want to thank DJ Convoy. You can follow him on Blue Sky at djconvoy.bluesky.social. You can read his written series, More Dangerous Than Dynamite, and other various musings that he has on La Zona Muerte, Muerta, my apologies, .net, LAZONAMUERTA.net. I should say, for everyone that I'm thanking here, there'll be links and whatnot in the description below. I would also like to thank Verb Abrams. You can follow Verb Abrams at Verb Abrams on Twitter or Blue Sky. He actually just recently wrote a new article on Voices of Wrestling titled Wrestlers Are and Are Not Content. You can listen to his ballot episode, which was the first of this season, all about Ted Boy Marino. And of course, he wrote an article about Ted Boy Marino that accompanied that episode. Kyle from the Apron Bump Podcast. You can listen to the Apron Bump Podcast wherever podcasts can be found. It's a show where Kyle and a guest discuss a pay-per-view from a bunch of different wrestling timelines, including WWE, WCW, ECW, TNA, etc., etc. You get the idea. I joined him once to discuss WWF's In Your House 14, Revenge of the Taker. What a show that was. It made a great podcast, but not necessarily a great pay-per-view. So you can listen to that and wherever more podcasts can be found. You can listen to his ballot episode on patreon.com/countoutpod, all about Kevin Owens. I want to thank Jesse Collings for sending in audio. He's, of course, the host of the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast on Voices of Wrestling, where he also writes many an article. You can find both of those works at voicesofwrestling.com or wherever podcasts can be found. I want to thank Kevin Hare. You can read Kevin and co-writer Robin Reed's Wrestling 101 project at voicesofwrestling.com, where they slowly create a list of 101 wrestling matches that you should have watched in order to be fluent in the language of wrestling. Currently, they are at match number 76, so you have plenty of time to catch up before the end of the series. But I'm sure also that series will just probably live on forever on the website, so you'll always be able to go back and check out Wrestling 101. You can listen to his ballot episode on patreon.com/countoutpod about both Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn. We did sort of a group them together instead of solo episodes as well, so that we can sort of discuss their tag team appeal. Alex Richards. I want to thank Alex Richards. He's the co-host of Stardom Quest, a weekly podcast about World Wonder Ring Stardom, covering news, reviews, previews, and more. Listen wherever podcasts can be found. He also does write a little bit for, not a little bit, I think it's a good amount, for VoicesWrestling.com as well. You can listen to Alex's ballot episode on patreon.com/countoutpod, all about Asuka. Gerard DiTrolio, co-host of the Emerald Flow Show. I want to thank you. This is Emerald Flow Show, a podcast about the Japanese wrestling promotions of Pro Wrestling Noah and All Japan Pro Wrestling. And sometimes they filter in, you know, some of the smaller promotions in Japan as well. You can listen wherever podcasts can be found. You can also listen to his ballot episode on patreon.com/countoutpod, all about Kento Miyahara. And finally, I want to thank our next guest, which will actually be the person you hear first, right after I'm done speaking. You'll hear this person next. A man that, you know, when given the task of recording 4 to 10 minutes of audio on Sabu's Hall of Fame candidacy, you know, he went over and sent in 19 minutes to genuinely no shock at all for me. Greatly appreciate it no matter what time length I got. He and his co-host Rich Kreitz released a 3-hour episode about Sabu's life and career, and are somehow mad that they didn't get to all of it, which is, you know, it's fine. We got 3 hours. It was great. You know, this is a man that actually, in fact, inspired me to sort of create the Ballot podcast. When I a couple years ago listened to their yearly Hall of Fame coverage, and he said something to the effect of, you know, the Observer doesn't really give enough time to research all the little candidates that are added on every single year. I sat there and I thought to myself, well, I can certainly talk about the new people. You know, I won't be able to get to everybody, but the new people that get added on every single year, other people talk about the ones that are already there. Anyways, this is a big full circle moment for me. So without further ado, I'll let him intro himself, as you, the listener, can now sit back and enjoy the rest of the ballot on Sabu's Hall of Fame case.
Hey guys, this is Joe Lanza of the Flagship Podcast, flagshippatreon.com. I want to thank Ryan for inviting me to give some thoughts, my thoughts, on Sabu's potential Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame case. You know, I have always been a supporter and an advocate for Sabu being inducted in the Observer Hall of Fame. And the only reason I haven't advocated for Sabu in recent years is because he was no longer on the ballot. So for those of you that don't know, Rich Kreitz and I do about a half a dozen audio shows behind our paywall every year discussing the Hall of Fame and breaking down each category. And so much of my effort as a voter over the last decade and someone who takes the Hall of Fame process seriously and loves discussing it every year, it goes into the candidates that are on the ballot. So I haven't really had a chance to flesh out my thoughts on Sabu's Hall of Fame case in a number of years because he hasn't been on the ballot. But I suspect Dave will put Sabu back on the ballot this year. I would be very surprised if he didn't. Generally, when a legend passes away, if they have fallen off the ballot, Dave will give him another crack at it, since people, this sort of unfortunate byproduct of someone passing away is people will then zero in on and study their careers once they've passed, which is both a good thing and an unfortunate thing in a weird way. But it does lead to Dave putting people back on the ballot, which I think is good because it gets people talking about those careers again, and it gets people maybe thinking about a candidate in a different way that they weren't thinking about when the person was alive. So I do expect Sabu to be back on the ballot, and if he is, I will once again advocate strongly for his inclusion. So here's why. When it comes to the Hall of Fame, I am a strict by the letter of the law voter, okay? Meaning when Dave Meltzer sends the ballot out each year, he essentially gives you three criteria to look at to decide whether or not you're going to vote for a candidate. Now, I'll read them to you straight from the ballot itself. It says, and I quote, "The criteria for the Hall of Fame is a combination of drawing power, being a great in-ring performer or excelling in one's field in pro wrestling, as well as having historical significance in a positive manner. A candidate should either have something to offer in all three categories or be someone so outstanding in one or two of those categories that they deserve inclusion," end quote. So basically, you've got drawing power, which is self-explanatory, work, which for a wrestler is pretty self-explanatory and pretty subjective, right? Up to the voter, whether you think somebody is a Hall of Fame level worker. I guess they're all subjective, but drawing is a little more cut and dry, although reasonable minds could disagree whether someone's considered a Hall of Fame level draw. And then sort of this more ambiguous, having historical significance in a positive manner. And I'll get to that one in a second. But when it comes to the Hall of Fame, all of the greatest all-time draws in pro wrestling history are essentially in this Hall of Fame already, as well they should be. It seems as though that piece of the criteria is the one that voters seem to take the most seriously or seem to place the most weight on. And I'm not sure why, because I read to you verbatim the criteria for voting, and there's no extra weight or emphasis put on any of those three areas, or at least there shouldn't be. But I think we all fall into the trap as voters, as pro wrestling being the pro wrestling business, we tend to emphasize the draws and we tend to place more weight on that category than the others. Why? I don't know. But if you look at the Hall of Fame, there are more all-time great draws in the Hall of Fame who were not also great workers than the opposite. In other words, there's less all-time great workers in the Hall of Fame who didn't have much to offer in the area of drawing ability than there are great draws who didn't have as much to offer in the area of work. So, you know, you could probably think, if you think about this right now, you could probably think of several all-time great draws who wouldn't have gotten into the Hall of Fame if drawing wasn't part of the criteria based on their work alone, right? I mean, an obvious example would be somebody like Hulk Hogan. Hulk Hogan, in his younger years, was a very good wrestler and a very good worker. But I don't think Hulk Hogan is making any work rate Hall of Fames. The reason he's in the Observer Hall of Fame and should be is because he's one of the greatest pro wrestling draws of all time. He ticks that box as hard as anyone ever, and you really don't even need to look at his work or his historical significance, which I believe he would check the box for the third category too, because his drawing is so overwhelming that he's in, right? And I am making a larger point here on Sabu, if you bear with me. There are some examples of wrestlers who tick the in-ring performance box so strong that they don't really need the other two boxes. And that Tomohiro Ishii would be a great example, who got in recently. He's in based on his work rate. He's in based on his work. Nobody would argue that Tomohiro Ishii was an all-time Hall of Fame level wrestling draw. He has his share of singles main events, and I put together an advocacy case for Big Tom Ish a couple of years ago that pointed out that he may have more main events than you think, but there's no reasonable way you can make a Hall of Fame drawing case for Tomohiro Ishii. He's in because he's one of the greatest workers of his era and thus one of the great workers of all time in the eyes of the voters. That's why he's in. He doesn't tick either of the other two boxes. So the point I'm getting to here with Sabu is I believe he ticks that third box, historical significance. I believe he ticks that box as hard as any other candidate, as any other entry into the Hall of Fame has ticked either of the other two boxes. But there aren't that many, if any, candidates who have gotten into this Hall of Fame by simply ticking the historical significant box. I mean, think about it. Can you think of one off the top of your head? There's many Hall of Famers who just tick the drawing box, or the drawing box is ticked so strongly that that's why they're in the Hall of Fame. You can find a few examples like Ishii of great workers who are in the Hall of Fame for simply being great workers. Sabu's historical significance is just that, deeply significant. It's almost impossible to watch a pro wrestling show today without seeing Sabu and his influence. Sabu changed everything in the early to mid 90s. And it's not just for popularizing table spots, which some of you might argue is not historical significance in a positive manner, because you might be so sick of seeing table spots, but using chairs and tables as props, it's not just that. That's the obvious stuff. If you go back and watch Sabu's early work, it changed the way wrestlers approached and worked their matches forever. He had a very infamous cult favorite match against the Lightning Kid in Minnesota in 1993, and there was recently an audio clip being passed around Twitter of Wade Keller's call-in radio show after that event where Sabu wrestled the Lightning Kid, and just to listen to people in real time discussing that match, talking about how it was arguably the greatest match they'd ever seen, and they were seeing moves that they had never seen before, and Wade Keller going on and on about how they dove out of the ring at least 10 to 15 times, and sunset flips from inside the ring off the apron to the floor. And what you have to understand about Sabu, especially if you're of a certain age, is all of the things that are extremely common in pro wrestling today that you see not just nearly on every show, but nearly every match, were completely unheard of before Sabu, where a dive outside the ring is just used as a spot to get to a commercial break on a Raw or SmackDown today. These were dynamic, world-changing moves that Sabu was performing in real time. Sabu undoubtedly is one of the most influential wrestlers in the history of professional wrestling. Full stop. He not only innovated the modern hardcore style of wrestling, but he changed the way that pro wrestling is worked forever. And that can't be understated. He ushered in a completely new era of professional wrestling, one that influenced everything that came after it and still endures today. So when you look at the three criteria for the Hall of Fame, and when you look at the way that we are asked to vote on the Hall of Fame, a candidate should have something to offer in all three categories, or be someone so outstanding in one or two of those categories that they deserve inclusion. Sabu ticks that historical significant box as hard as anybody in the Hall of Fame ticks the drawing box or the working box for me. And I think that is undeniable, and that would be enough. And while I'm not even going to attempt to make a Hall of Fame drawing case for Sabu, because it does not exist, I do think where he does get shortchanged is in the category of great in-ring performer or excelling in one's field of pro wrestling. I think because Sabu later in his career almost became a parody of himself, right? he was just the older, broken down guy who was getting booked on name value, who you knew was going to crash through some tables. I think you forget how well regarded he was as a worker during his peak, which I would define as about 1991 through 1995. That would be the rough stretch of time where I would consider Sabu at his peak. And his peak year, in my view, was 1994. And just to demonstrate what his reputation was as a worker in that time period, in 1994, Sabu, who was not working for a national television promotion, who was working primarily in Japan for FMW, okay, and in the United States, mostly for ECW. His home base was ECW in the United States, and he was working various indies. Essentially, he very rarely worked in front of crowds of 1,000 people or more in the United States, and was working for FMW, not even New Japan or All Japan, back in Japan. Sabu finished second in the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Awards for both the Flair Thez MVP Award, which is essentially the roll-up award for Wrestler of the Year, and Most Outstanding. In fact, he finished second in Most Outstanding, which is the Bell-to-Bell Wrestler of the Year, and actually had more first-place votes than the winner, Kenta Kobashi. Sabu nearly swept the two most prestigious awards in the Observer Awards in 1994, without ever working on national television in the United States and working for FMW in Japan, not even New Japan or All Japan. And ECW at that time hadn't even peaked yet and hadn't even reached its full, its broadest television reach in terms of the number of markets it was airing in. I mean, that's almost unthinkable today that that could happen. And it wasn't just the Observer voters either. In the Torch Awards in 1994, Sabu did in fact win the Torch equivalent to Most Outstanding. He won the Best Work Rate Award in 1994 over Shawn Michaels, Bret Hart, Ric Flair. He won the Independent MVP that year, which would be expected. And he finished second in U.S. United States MVP, because the Torch did it a little bit different than the Observer. They didn't have a roll-up award for MVP or Wrestler of the Year. They broke it down into American, Japanese, Mexican, and independent MVPs. But he finished second overall in American MVP to Bret Hart. And to show you what people thought of Sabu's work in real time, the Torch also, in those days, would do a top 100 rating of, this was crowdsourced, this was done via poll of the readers of the publication. So they would list the top 100 ratings of the top workers in each given year. And in 1994, Sabu was listed as the 7th best worker in the world. Some of the names below him, directly below him in the poll, include Shawn Michaels, Jushin Thunder Liger, Steve Dr. Death Williams, Psychosis, Eddie Guerrero, Negro Casas, Bret Hart, Rey Mysterio Jr., Vader, Stan Hansen, Nobuhiko Takada, and a host of others. And that sustained through 1995, where Sabu, now to me a little bit past his peak as a worker, came in at number 26 in the Torch top 100 wrestlers in the world. And I just think that what this demonstrates is that I think due to years of Sabu, again, almost being a parody of himself, that a lot of people forget that at his peak, and it wasn't a long peak, it couldn't be with his style. His body started to break down. By 95, 96, he wasn't quite the same worker. He was still great. He wasn't the mythical sort of underground phenomenon that he was between 91 and 90 and 94. But at Sabu's peak, which fell sometime between 91 and 95, that short peak, he was in fact considered one of the best workers in the world. And it wasn't just because he was going through tables and jumping off of chairs. He really was a great overall worker who incorporated those types of spots into great pro wrestling matches. So, do I think Sabu has any semblance of a Hall of Fame drawing case? No, I do not. Yes, he was a nice draw at the indie level. Barely legal, did a nice little buy rate for ECW, built around Sabu versus Taz. He had the John Cena pay-per-view match in WWE that did okay. But there's no drawing case to be made. But do I think that that Sabu has something to offer in the area of great in-ring performer? I do. You're talking about someone who was considered one of the best workers in the world for a 3 or 4 year stretch, peaking in 1994, where at least one segment of the hardcore fan base, the Torch readership, thought he was the best wrestler in the world. And he won their best work rate award and finished top 10 in their poll of the best wrestlers in the world, of the best workers in the world. So I've gone way over time here. I just think that on influence / historical significance alone, Sabu is an absolute no-brainer for the Hall of Fame. But if you're a voter and you're listening to this, I would encourage you to go back and watch some of his matches from about 1993 to 1995 and reconsider his work as well. I think he does have something to offer in that area. I think the real-time opinions of his work placed him amongst the best wrestlers in the world, and I think that's worth something. And to me, I think that Sabu is an easy Hall of Fame yes based on his influence alone. And I'll leave you with this, since I'm already over time. Sabu was a direct influence of one of the most influential wrestlers ever, Hayabusa. Hayabusa, if he were alive today, would tell you that he was directly influenced and he directly copied Sabu. And Hayabusa himself is one of the most influential wrestlers in the world that we've ever seen. And he was directly influenced by Sabu. So how can I sit here and tell you I voted for Hayabusa and tell you that Hayabusa is a Hall of Famer and then not tell you that you should vote for Sabu? I can't do it. Thanks, Ryan.
Hey, this is Adam Berger, contributor for Voices of Wrestling. Sabu. What can you say about Sabu? My first memory of Sabu was as a kid watching early Monday Nitro. Sabu had some matches against Alex Wright, Disco Inferno, and Mr. JL, a masked Jerry Lynn. And man, as a kid watching that, it was unlike anything I had ever seen before. In wrestling. When Nitro first started, you got to remember, this is before the cruiserweight division. So like there was no Rey Mysterio or Psicosis or any of the luchadors or high flyers that came into WCW in, you know, 96 and 97. So when Sabu was doing all these crazy dives and breaking tables, it really was completely unlike anything kids had seen that were just watching mainstream wrestling. He was only there for a few weeks, but boy, did he make an impression on me. And I think a lot of other fans too. I've discovered ECW then a few years later. And man, once I did, I was obsessed. I had to get like all the ECW, tapes and DVDs that I could. And just, man, talk about expanding your horizons to a completely different world of wrestling. And Sabu was just such a huge part of that. He really was like one of the things that really made ECW special back then. And then learning more about his career, you know, he also introduced me to FMW with, you know, the fire and exploding cages and barbed wire and ultra violence that existed there. So just, such an innovator. all over the world, you know, both in the US and Japan. And then, man, it was really a shame he never got like more consistent work on a bigger platform, but he was always just going from, you know, place to place. And even the stuff later in his career, like, you know, his TNA work with Raven and Abyss, and some other guys, it was always fun when he showed up and had, would still have like some crazy matches even into the 2000s. And then, you know, him being part of One Night Stands and being part of the ECW revival in WWE was one of the reasons that gave a lot of us hope that, hey, this could be really cool. Like ECW actually getting a second chance. And man, what could be now if we have ECW with WWE's financial backing? This is going to be incredible. Oh man, so much hope and so much disappointment. But it was still cool that Sabu got that run on such a large platform, to allow a lot of, you know, fans who maybe hadn't seen him before to experience him. And even then, I mean, he still stood out and had some very memorable matches and spots, like, you know, that leg drop through the announce table on John Cena, or hitting Rey Mysterio with a springboard DDT to the outside through a table. So even late into his career, like for 20 years, this guy was just doing like death-defying stunts that created a lot of indelible memories for anyone who is a fan of his and watched him. And if you look at wrestling, like there really is, and the evolution of wrestling, there really is, you know, wrestling before Sabu and then wrestling after Sabu. He inspired everyone that you see breaks tables. They break tables, you know, because of Sabu. He was also a direct inspiration for Hayabusa's wrestling style and Hayabusa's attire. The pants are very clearly a copy of Sabu's pants. And obviously, I think Hayabusa is one of the most influential wrestlers as well. So, you know, and Sabu was the guy who inspired and influenced Hayabusa. So when we get to the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, this year, Sabu will definitely be someone that I'm supporting and talking about the same way that I do Hayabusa. You know, I think the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, we want to have the biggest draws in there. We want to have the best workers and performers in there. And then we also want to have the most historically significant acts. So that's open to interpretation. But in my opinion, you know, we want to have some of the most innovative wrestlers and some of the most influential wrestlers included in that Hall of Fame to really tell the story of wrestling history and who mattered the most. And very few wrestlers were more influential than Sabu.
Hi, I'm Justin, probably better known to most of you in the internet wrestling community at large as DJ Convoy. I've been asked to say a couple of words about Sabu and his potential Observer Hall of Fame candidacy. I'm not even sure the first time I saw Sabu was. I got into WCW shortly after the beginning of Monday Night Nitro, and Sabu was really only in WCW for about 2 months after Nitro started, so it probably wasn't there. It's very likely that I saw him for the first time on the "Did This Show Suck Without ECW or What?" episode of Raw, where ECW invaded. I can't really remember what I thought about him. He sort of fell off the giant Raw letter entrance, but in a way, that sort of encapsulates Sabu, doesn't it? Willing to take risks and fail. His aura was completely unlike that of any other wrestler. It wasn't that he had the tough guy menace of a Stan Hansen or a Steve Williams. It wasn't that he had the exotic menace of Abdullah the Butcher. It was more of a bizarre blend of those things. This guy was so wild that he'd rather hurt himself to make sure he beat his opponent as opposed to wrestling a clean match. His whole deal was spectacle. Dramatic successes and equally dramatic failures, crashing and burning as much as crushing his foes. If you go back and read the newsletters of the time or wrestling magazines, they would talk about him like he was some sort of mysterious presence who came to town, did a crazy stunt, smashed a table, and then left. No, he didn't invent going through a table, but he obviously popularized it. I've seen shows in Japan or the Wild West Indies of the mid-90s where people would be disappointed he didn't go through a table in a match, so he'd simply do it afterwards. I suppose just to build his mystique that much further. Say what you will about him as a performer, but building Sabu versus Taz for so long in ECW and making it a focal point of their first pay-per-view was incredibly important for the company. His presence was unmatched, and that act of restraint, keeping Taz and Sabu apart for well over a year, 100% gave that first pay-per-view an irresistible hook. I can't say I'm stunned that he's gone. Despite the marketing hype, he was still human after all, and he took a ridiculous amount of damage over his career. I mean, he took one of the stupidest, most dangerous bumps I've ever seen, and that was just a little bit over 3 weeks ago during his retirement match. Just one of those kind of men you can't picture doing anything else but being in pro wrestling. One of nature's own bizarre prototypes. As for his Hall of Fame potential, the three main criteria in the Observer Hall of Fame are drawing power, overall working ability, and influence, with a sort of slight fourth category of longevity. Drawing power, there's no question he was a draw on the indie level. In the 90s, his presence was nearly ubiquitous in any of the larger indies back then. As I said before, you can probably attribute a lot of the curiosity surrounding ECW's first pay-per-view specifically to his feud with Taz. He was also in demand in a number of Japanese companies, and eventually had runs in TNA and WWE. His specific ability to draw probably cooled off somewhat after the ECW run. WWE wasn't going to main event WrestleMania with him. But he was always in demand, even in his later years, especially in shows catering towards ECW nostalgia. Working ability is more of a mixed bag. I'm not sure if I can point you to a ton of classic matches of his, although he does have some, so much as I could memorable spots. But what can't be overstated would be his influence on both the scene at large as well as to future wrestlers. I would go so far as to say he might have a near Dynamite Kid level of influence on workers that followed him. As far as his longevity, he started in 1985, and he was still delivering what I would consider to be a Sabu-style match literally until the very end, even if those kind of risks are probably ultimately what led to his passing. Is he a slam-dunk Observer Hall of Fame candidate? That's hard to say. Probably not. Should he be on the ballot and discussed? Absolutely. Thanks for listening.
Let out all the stops. That's what the Sheik told his nephew, Terry Brunk, a tag-along designated bump taker for the overripe uncle on an unexpected late career tour of Japan. Let out all the stops. Those are probably the most important words Sabu ever heard professionally. And those words ignited one of the wildest careers in wrestling history. Sabu let out all the stops. And he'll be remembered as an ultimate risk taker. Having been shot in the head at 19 years old, maybe Sabu actually was playing with house money. Maybe his gambling was logical. Either way, he would do things fans and wrestlers had never seen before. Sabu was a maverick because he was determined to be one. When someone else tried to copy some crazy spot, Sabu would ratchet up the action and go even further, fueled by a dual purpose of keeping his matches looking as realistic as possible, while simultaneously raising the in-ring bar so high that no one in the locker room could match it. Sabu was influential, but he didn't want to be. There was never a tree of wrestlers that sprouted because Sabu cultivated them. Though his tag partner used the nickname, Sabu was one of a kind. And he was determined to stay that way. That approach can take years off someone's life, and with Sabu it most certainly did. Sabu probably had several causes of death. The loss of his partner, substance abuse, but chief among them is wrestling. His highlight reels are a catalog of pain and mutilation. Those were real scars. That was real muscle visible through that gash. Sabu was a person who lived his gimmick 24/7, long past the time it was expected of wrestlers, but he was also undeniably real. And he traded old age to pursue his vision of pro wrestling. And that deserves reflection and respect. I was in the building for Sabu's final match, but I left to attend another show before the match hit the ring. If Sabu shows up, jokes had peppered the weekend, mostly because there was a big concern that he would not show up. And at the time, we didn't know Sabu was unable to walk hours before the match and was barely able to make it to the ring without chemical assistance. From our phones, we watched a spaced-out Sabu struggle through a slow-motion spectacle. We watched him go face-first through the web of wire. We watched him careen across the ring and onto his neck on the polished concrete floor. And we watched him mid-match stop swinging his chair to hug it out with his opponent. It was Ali versus Burbick in a barbed wire ring. Sabu let out all the stops, but sometimes there should be stops. I recognize Sabu as an athlete, an incredibly gutsy performer, an independent draw during a downtime for wrestling, and low-key one of the funnier guys when he let down his guard, but I would not vote for him this year. Part of the criteria for induction is historical significance in a positive manner. And while Sabu is certainly historically significant, personally, I need more time to consider how positive that significance has been.
What's up, everybody? This is Kyle from the Apron Bump Podcast, former guest on Count Out Wrestling Network. Glad to be back, and especially glad to have the opportunity to speak on a bona fide legend. That word legend, I mean, it gets thrown around a lot, but if there's anybody that embodies that word, it's someone like Sabu. Innovative, revolutionary, doesn't even begin to describe what Sabu did for wrestling. A lot of these high-flying, kind of death-defying maneuvers, you know, springboards, diving into the crowd, using chairs to kind of propel you, throwing chairs at there are so many facets of wrestling, particularly hardcore wrestling, that were brought, at least brought to the mainstream and popularized, if not invented, by Sabu. So in terms of the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, does he deserve a spot in it? Short stories short, I would say yes, absolutely. His influence on the industry is profound. Obviously, most people, when they think of Sabu, they think of ECW. And guys like Taz and Rob Van Dam, they may very well have never been the stars that they ended up being had it not been for Sabu to be there and provide them with compelling feuds, energetic matches, legendary matches and feuds in ECW, not only to build those individual guys up, but to build the company of ECW. The first ever pay-per-view that ECW ever got was formed on the back of the feud between Sabu and Taz. He's a bona fide Mount Rushmore guy from ECW and is one of the major factors that set ECW apart from the other promotions. And both WWF and WCW plucked a lot of stuff from ECW and a lot of the stuff that Sabu was had a big hand in doing. So his impact on the industry, all that to say, his impact on the industry is well documented and it's undeniable. To this day, some of the stuff that GCW is doing, including his very last match, all of that stuff is Sabu at the core. Other criteria, length of time spent in wrestling. I mean, like I just mentioned, he just had a match in GCW, what, a month or so ago? And he started wrestling, I believe, in the late 80s. Through ECW, TNA, WWE, a little bit of WCW in there. I mean, this guy's been all around the world. Japan, of course, wrestled in bingo halls. He's wrestled at WrestleMania. His TNA run, something that's very undervalued, but go back and watch his matches with Abyss, with, you know, Raven, Monty Brown. His run in TNA was fun. And that kind of sucks. And wrestling ability, of course, another criteria of this Hall of Fame situation. Sabu's one of those guys, kind of like Sid, kind of like Mongo, where if you listen to the internet too much and don't actually look into him, you might have this idea that Sabu was like this botch machine. Sabu doesn't get the recognition he gets for being as smooth as he was, as innovative. He would just add a little extra twist or a little extra spring to his offense. Very believable stuff. Sabu didn't make his name off of promos, that's for damn sure. His wrestling spoke for himself, his presence, his unspoken charisma. No other wrestler in the world is like Sabu. But to play devil's advocate, some other things to consider that might go against his candidacy in the Hall of Fame here. For one, he really kind of just stayed in one niche. The hardcore kind of deathmatch kind of scene, the ECW-esque type of matches. If Sabu didn't have a steel chair to work with or, you know, tables to go through, might have been kind of neutered in a sense at that point. But he had a match with RVD where the ropes broke and he couldn't use the ropes and they still had a great match. Now, he didn't reach high levels in WWE or WCW or anything. And some may say that he kind of was pigeonholed into a certain niche of a niche. But we also got to consider that he pretty much cultivated that niche. He kind of built it from the ground up. He was the niche. I don't even know what you would call it, because Sabu's style was so unique and so unlike anybody else's. So while, yeah, he kind of stuck to one lane, but that lane was built by him, and it's a lane that so many people have traveled since he built that lane. So overall, I would say, yes, he deserves a spot in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. I think his influence is, like I said, I feel like I'm repeating myself, and I apologize, but I feel like his influence is so profound, and it's deep-rooted in so many stars of today, so... Shout out Sabu, one of the greatest. Rest in peace.
Hey everybody, Jesse Collings, host of the Gentleman's Wrestling Podcast here. When I think about Sabu's case for the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, the two things that jump out to me are first, the first category, which we often refer to as work, right? Category one, was someone a good worker or not? Were they a worker that would make them a Hall of Fame level candidate? And that's not actually the category. The category is not work. We use work as a shorthand, but the actual category is excelling in one's field as a professional wrestler and is used to encompass not just bell-to-bell work, but things like promos and charisma and aura and mystique and all of that kind of other aspects that make someone a memorable professional wrestler. And so when we think about Sabu, it's not that he was like a great bell-to-bell worker in a traditional sense. He's not someone that was going to go in there and do a bunch of holds, and he's not someone that's going to have necessarily a bunch of five-star matches or the kind of things that we use often to hold as a standard when we think about that first category. But to me, he was an incredible professional wrestler at his peak from, you know, 1992 to maybe 1997, when you had a guy who absolutely had charisma and aura. And when he would come into a show, people would be blown away with the kind of work that he was doing. And people thought that he was worth the price of admission, right? He maybe wasn't the biggest draw in the sense that he was wrestling in front of 10,000 people every week, like we often think of when we use draw as a standard, but he was somebody that was able to consistently pop independent groups that he was working for during a time, mind you, where both WCW and WWF were really, really struggling to find anyone that could be a drawing card. They were relying a lot on nostalgia acts or trying to push new wrestlers that weren't connecting with the audience. But Sabu, in his own way, was able to become a successful draw. I remember the other day reading John Muse, who's very in tune to like the indie scene in the 90s in the Michigan area where Sabu first kind of broke out, where he would say that Sabu would double the attendance figures that independent promoters had, which was really incredible when you think about it, because you're doing that without television. You're doing that without, he's not someone that had been on TV like an old star from the territory days or a WWF washout or something like that. And this is a time period where basically there were no real strong drawing cards in America. But it's that performance, that level of mystique that he had that I think makes him an intriguing candidate for the first category. A lot of people wouldn't think of him as a work candidate, but he was somebody that definitely, I think, excelled in the field of professional wrestling to the degree that he had a very memorable career, largely because of the matches he was having, right? It wasn't just because he was charismatic or he could cut promos, because he, I don't think he could cut promos that well, and but he was certainly charismatic. But that bell would ring and he would take the fans to another place. People believed in him. People believed in his act. People thought he was dangerous. People thought that he was exciting. People thought that he was thrilling. He was worth the price of admission. And that's really what you want when you reflect on a professional wrestler. In the historical significance side, he's obviously a historically significant wrestler, one of the most historically significant wrestlers of the last 40 years. He is somebody who, when you really think about it, really has a huge influence on today's wrestling. You see that kind of Sabu style, wild, crazy plunder brawls on pretty much every wrestling promotion in the world. Even like a promotion like New Japan Pro Wrestling just had one where they had that War Dogs versus House of Torture match. And that was a match that used a lot of Sabu stuff. I mean, right down to Kato jumping off the top of the cage and going through the table, but failing to actually go through the table. I mean, that was straight out of a Sabu match. And we're seeing that in 2025. And so in that sense, I think he has. And you could argue that it wasn't necessarily all positive, right? You could say that he pushed wrestling away from a more traditional mat-based, grappling-based style and turned it so like a lot of big matches now would be settled with guys just lurching from one high spot to another. So it, you could argue that, but I don't think Sabu had a lot of control over that. All he did was he did something where he did a style of match that was really popular and a lot of people wanted to copy it. And he also helped modernize the kind of wild and chaotic brawls that took place before him, because he didn't invent wild and chaotic brawls, but things like the matches like his uncle the Sheik did and Abdullah the Butcher and Bruiser Brody, he took that and also incorporated a lot of modern stuff or stuff that we associate with modern stuff, right? Dives outside the ring, use of tables, use of chairs, all that kind of stuff he helped popularize. So I think those two categories are really strong for him. And I think some people will say this. It's not something I personally agree with, and maybe someone else in this episode will say it or has already said it, depending on when this gets booted into the queue. I don't think the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame is something that like you should tell the history of wrestling through, because I just don't agree with that argument in the sense that when people say you can't tell the history of wrestling without mentioning blank. And it's like, that's kind of arbitrary, because depending on how much detail you want to go into, you can explain the history of wrestling with or without a lot of different aspects that some people would view as integral to the history of wrestling. But I do think that the Hall of Fame should stand as some sort of level of historical record, so that when we are looking back on the history of professional wrestling and we see someone's name in there and we have to assume, say, that person must have been pretty damn good, or that person must have been pretty damn important. And I think 50 years from now, when somebody is looking at who's in the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame, and they are looking at all these names and they see the name Sabu, they're going to say to themselves, man, that guy must have been interesting because he's in the Hall of Fame. I wonder what he was like. And they'll go on to whatever the future version of YouTube is, and they'll look and they'll see this guy. And I don't know how well his act will age. You could argue that a lot of it hasn't aged well already, and we're only a couple decades removed from his peak. But I think they'll go back and they'll see, wow, this guy was something. This guy was exciting. This guy was important in a way that someone like Randy Orton wouldn't be, right? Randy Orton's also going to be on this ballot in the modern US category. And it's like, okay, Randy Orton maybe is a better bell-to-bell worker than Sabu. And maybe Randy Orton has the kind of drawing record that you would want, right? He's main evented a ton of shows that drew 10,000 people, and he's headlined a bunch of pay-per-views and all that kind of stuff like that. But does Randy Orton have like 1 ounce of the importance or historical significance that it feels like Sabu has had to professional wrestling? Is professional wrestling any different with Randy Orton in it? I don't think so. And that's why I think Sabu is such an intriguing candidate. And I'll close my portion with this. My first kind of time I ever heard about Sabu, I was much too young to watch him at his peak. I was born in 1994, which was like the peak of Sabu's career. But the first time I ever heard about him, I was a kid. I was watching SmackDown. It's probably around like 2005, 2006. And they're building up to One Night Stand, and Paul Heyman is on SmackDown, and Paul Heyman is cutting a promo, and they're talking about how who Rey Mysterio is going to face at One Night Stand, and you know, Heyman goes, you know, you're going to face the homicidal, suicidal, genocidal Sabu, and you know, the entire audience goes, oh my god, and the announcers go, oh my god, he's gonna wrestle Sabu, and Rey Mysterio's reacting crazy, and I was like, man, who is this guy Sabu? I've never even heard of him before, but the way everyone is reacting to him, he's got to be like some sort of incredible legendary figure, and I'm so excited to go and see him. And I didn't know who Sabu was. I think I remember thinking he was like some, he was probably going to be like a 450-pound black guy or something like that. He was very different than what I ended up expecting him to be. But it was that moment where I was like, okay, this is just someone who has a historically been presented as a true dangerous legendary figure in pro wrestling. And when he got announced for a match, everyone went crazy and thought it was cool. And I always use that as an example to push back against the idea that you need to have video packages. You need to explain who these wrestlers are to the audience in great detail, because otherwise they're not going to understand it. I always think back to when I was a little kid and I was very impressionable watching wrestling. And when they just said, you know, his name, Sabu, they made it seem like such a big deal. On that episode of SmackDown, that I immediately was very interested in who this person was. And so that's when I think about Sabu, that's what I'll think about it. And I think he's definitely a strong candidate for the Hall of Fame this year.
All right. So I think that there are certain wrestlers where you can point to wrestling before them and after them. And Sabu is absolutely one of them. He was not the first wild man wrestler. He was not necessarily the first high-flying wrestler. And he was not the first, you know, hardcore-style brawling type of wrestler. But what he was is he was able to combine all of these things into something new, something futuristic, something modern, and he was able to just stick off the page in a way that nobody else ever did before, and in a lot of ways since have never really done. He never talked, and he had this quiet charisma about him, but that all just made him, it was all part of the package, and it made it even worse, it made him feel even a bigger star. It made him feel crazier and more mysterious. And he dangerous. And in a business that, you know, celebrates the idea of being dangerous, Sabu is there's no one that feels crazier than him. There's no one that feels like anything can go right, can go wrong. I think everybody kind of has the image of Sabu standing on top of the middle of the ropes doing the triple jump moonsault. And I think everybody has that in their head of, you know, never knowing how that was going to end. He could fall onto his opponent. He could overshoot his opponent. He could fall right on the floor. I mean, anything could happen. And I think that that's really what a lot of the appeal for Sabu. And you know, the Hall of Fame case for Sabu, I've been a proponent for a few years now. I've been talking to different people. I've had some discussions with Joe Lanza and, you know, some very informal ones with John Muse and some other people. And I am a strong proponent at minimum of Sabu getting another shot at the Hall of Fame. I think that he absolutely deserves to be back on the ballot. I've been saying that for years. I'm not saying that because of the death bump. I think that Sabu is legitimately one of the most influential wrestlers of the past 30 to 40 years. You know, you don't want to give him necessarily credit for ECW, but at the same time, One, ECW probably should have some sort of strong representation in the Hall of Fame. And two, I think that he is the one most synonymous with the style of ECW. And I think that he is the one where when you think of the craziness and the high flying and the chairs and the brawling and all of that, I think that Sabu is the number one person that you think of for that. And not only was that major within the company, he became one of the bigger stars within the company and dictated their style. Again, you can't necessarily say that he's the full reason why they shifted towards that style. But when you have a guy like that in Sabu who is kind of trailblazing that style, of course you're going to lean into it. And then he influenced people like Terry Funk to go into that style as well. And I think that a lot of fans most associate Terry Funk with ECW and with that style, which Sabu directly influenced. But also, that brawling style has gone on to change wrestling ever since. It was very prominent in the Attitude Era. They borrowed a lot from ECW, which is very apparent. And that car crash style is on TV every single week. It's on major pay-per-views. There have been matches that are based around it all the time. People are doing Sabu type of things routinely, springboards and, you know, using the chairs and just everything. You see it all the time. And some people say that they don't know if that influence is positive or not. To me, you can't say that it's a negative influence because it affected the business and people made money off of it and using that style. So you can, in your brain, you can say that there would be some sort of wrestling utopia without that style, and oh, you know, it got too crazy, and if it went in this other direction, it would be better. But that's not what happened. It went in the direction that it went, and people made a lot of money off of that direction. Now, again, I don't want to overstate Sabu's influence on that. I don't think that he was necessarily the full catalyst for that, but again, he was one of the real trailblazers for that, and then directly influenced wrestlers, again, like Terry Funk, who attributed his change of style to Sabu, and Hayabusa, who is another well-debated candidate for the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. Hayabusa has been discussed quite a bit, and it seems like there's a good chance he will be getting in within the next few years. And there's not, you know, with this one, it's very cut and dry. Hayabusa was a Sabu ripoff. It is clear. Everybody knows that. And of course, he did his own thing and went on to influence countless others. But at the end of the day, Hayabusa took exactly what Sabu was doing, pretty much down to the look. And he had a mask, but otherwise very similar, and went on to also influence people. So I don't think you can give Hayabusa that sole influence. I think that you need to give that a lot to Sabu as well. And the last thing is that I'm a major proponent for the Observer Hall of Fame kind of expanding its scope a little bit. I think that focuses too much on the big companies and does not celebrate necessarily the other corners of wrestling that have changed wrestling forever. You know, guys like the Briscoes, Samoa Joe, you know, countless others, Kenta, who's never been on the ballot. I think that these are guys, Dragon Gate guys. Shima did get in, you know, and I think that's a good thing, but Great Sasuke is not on the ballot. So I think that these guys need to be evaluated and there is a space in the Hall of Fame for them. And I think that Sabu is right at the top of that list.
Okay, so the ballot for Sabu, the Hall of Fame candidacy for a guy like Sabu, I didn't think I would have strong feelings on this until I really sat down and thought about what I was going to say. And I feel like more and more I come to the side of the Observer Hall of Fame was made for a guy like Sabu. I think Dave intentionally added influence as one of the key kind of indicators for a reason, because sometimes the most innovative guy or the most innovative girl isn't going to be the five-star match haver, the top draw of the company. But sometimes they are somebody who causes a shift that is so undeniable that you just can't help but put them into something like this. And, you know, I think Dave Meltzer said it all. He said on Twitter, like, there's very few people who, if you take them out of wrestling history, is very different, but Sabu is one of those. And I do think just for that alone, I think he is an exceptional case for the influence kind of thing. Now, I don't think he has a work rate case. I don't think he has a drawing case. Those are a bit beyond him, I would say. But in terms of what he offered and what he did, I feel like he changed the way people viewed hardcore and deathmatch wrestling. You know, I think, no, I'm not an expert in this, but it does feel like it went from a much more grounded, like, fear of the weapons-based thing to just embracing the chaos and going, here's new ways to use chairs and new ways to use tables and new ways to use barbed wire to just really mess each other up. And I don't think you get the TLC matches in WWE without Sabu. I think you get, you know, the Dudley Boys being super over because of table spots without a guy like Sabu. I don't think RVD has like the coast to coast or the Van Dominator, one of those, without a guy like Sabu. And that just kind of goes on and on. Is everybody then who has done Plunder, who has done death matches or done extreme matches, is influenced in some way by those kind of ECW guys and those, and Sabu specifically? And he also got to do it in Japan, so he would have left his mark there too. So, you know, I think you'd have to obviously dive into it a lot more and maybe research it more, but I think this is a guy who completely shifted how pro wrestling works in terms of using weapons and how innovative you can be with them. I'm sure nobody was doing chair rope jumps before Sabu. And, you know, he just introduced people to a new way of thinking about that sort of stuff. And I feel like if the Observer Hall of Fame isn't for him, then what is? You know, how, like, who is meant to be honored in that influential bracket if not Sabu? You know, if not a guy who completely changed the game and completely changed how we view wrestling. So if it was up to me and I had a vote, I would 1000% vote for Sabu just because he completely changed the game. And the guy who made the Hall of Fame recognizes him as such. I don't want to argue with Dave on that. If Dave thinks he's the guy and he changed wrestling history, who am I to argue, really?
Hey there, this is Gerard DiTrollio from the Emerald Flow Show, part of the Voice of Wrestling podcast network. I'd just like to thank Ryan for inviting me back to give this little talk on the ballot about the Hall of Fame case for Sabu. You know, I think really one of the interesting things about talking about Sabu again is it's really a philosophical discussion about how one approaches the Hall of Fame ballot, you know, particularly with how Sabu's case, basically. Now, I do think Sabu is worthy of the Hall of Fame. I will be voting for Sabu if he reappears on the ballot, and I have a pretty good expectation that he will be. But so, you know, if we sort of want to break it down out of the three criteria, out of drawing, in-ring ability, and his positive historical significance, really, Sabu has only really one. Work, debatable, but even then, it's maybe for a couple of years in the 90s, maybe 93 to 96 or 97. You know, and people will have their criticisms of his, you know, tendency to botch, whether intentional or not. And his drawing is, you know, mostly indie. I mean, obviously he was a draw on the indies. He could command, you know, good money on an indie show and he would fill it up, but it's not the same as filling it at a 10,000 seat arena. So that goes ultimately to historical significance. We know that Sabu had a huge historical significance from everyone from Hayabusa to the fact that when you go to a wrestling show in North America and people are demanding the tables, that's not the Dudley Boys, that's really Sabu. So, you know, in terms of when we talk about this philosophy, you know, I am someone that is more than willing to vote for someone if they are overwhelming on one of the criteria. So just to put that in perspective, I'm a Tomohiro Ishii voter, And I think that he is one of the greatest workers of all time. Just the sheer volume that he has put out, not just over the last decade or so, 12 years in New Japan, but I, you know, have been watching Puro for almost over 25 years. And I have always identified him as this great underrated worker. And then eventually he, just how good he was able to shine in New Japan. So I'm willing to do that. And I'm willing to do that in the future for other great workers. So as far as Sabu goes, I think that he is also overwhelming in historical significance in a positive manner. No question about that. But the thing is, with most of these ballots, if you really think about it, there are a fair number of people that do get in overwhelmingly on one criteria, but it's the drawing, and it's less so on historical significance and work rate. You know, I think the most obvious recent case of getting in just basically by drawing would be Roman Reigns. I did not vote for Roman Reigns, although I maybe would, you know, in the future if he had managed not to get in, was on the ballot for a couple of more years. Right, he's been the top star in WWE for like a decade now, and he has headlined a number of stadium shows and whatnot. So that's the thing, right? People, because it's something that is very quantifiable, like gates, pay-per-view buys, attendances, they feel more comfortable, and it's just easier to understand how people comprehend it, of why they're going to mark for a Roman Reigns, even if they don't like Roman Reigns. Like, I don't watch WWE, but you know, I, you know, you cannot deny when it comes to a huge draw that, you know, I have no compulsion about that. I will vote for horrible in-ring wrestlers if they are massive draws. So I think, you know, that sort of thinking on willingness to vote for someone who excels so high in just one of their criteria, you know, needs to be sort of expanded beyond the default of it's easy to see how someone is a draw. Right now, look, you're getting into more subjective debates, of course, when it comes to in-ring and positive historical significance, and I understand that. But I don't think that that's no reason to run away. If you feel that strongly about someone in one of those categories, then you should absolutely do it. So that's why I'll be voting for Sabu. You know, and that's also a reason why I vote for Tigerjeet Singh. I think Tigerjeet Singh is a hugely historically significant figure. I think he's a horrible in-ring performer. Well, at least the technical part of the wrestler. You can talk about the persona and the entrance is one thing. But not a great in-ring technician, as it were. But he had a significant impact on the industry in Japan as that foreign brawling heel. Not the only one, of course. But, you know, the biggest heel in New Japan in the mid-70s, you know, was a pretty high-profile star in the mid-80s, jumping to All Japan around 1980-1981, where he continued to sort of headline against Baba in the main events as late as 1985, right? So, and then he sort of had a brief, a couple of big gates in the 90s in FMW against Onita and whatnot. So I think that all sort of puts together a case for Singh based on his historical significance. And so I bring the same sort of philosophy and approach to why I will be voting for Sabu. You do not have the sort of wrestling for ill or will. And I think, you know, you can critique it. I like a more straight-laced, athletic-based presentation of professional wrestling. But, you know, I have no problems and never had any issues with Sabu presented in the way he was, for a more brawling and unpredictable and hardcore, if even style. You know, I'm more against the more goofy sports entertainment. You know, Sabu really did have that aura of danger and everything like that. So, you know, that's my case for voting for Sabu. And that's just my case of why I think Observer Hall of Fame voters should be voting or should be more willing to vote for someone who is overwhelming in one of the criteria. And that's a perfectly legitimate way to get into the hall, be voted in the Hall of Fame, as Dave has said as much many times. I think, you know, they're going to be passionate. I don't see too much I'm against Sabu in the Hall of Fame talk, although I've seen a little. I'm not particularly convinced by it at all. I think it's hard to sort of avoid that the fingerprints and the legacy that Sabu left when you tune in to wrestling on American TV every week. It's all there. So, you know, I think, you know, Sabu taken from us too soon, which is unfortunate, and far too many people in this business have, you know, depart this world way too soon. And I think it is a very appropriate and fitting tribute to him that we recognize what he did for professional wrestling and vote him into the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame. And to all of the voters like myself out there, I really encourage you to sit back and when you're studying the candidates from on this year's ballot and ballots in the future, please consider their overall impact in the in-ring and at their positive historical significance, because I certainly think that the Hall of Fame is filled with all of the great draws of history, and I will certainly vote for all of the great draws that continue to be on the ballot, whether I personally like their output in the ring or not. And so I think, you know, as sort of wrestling fandom evolves, for ill or will, because I could say many ways that I do not enjoy that fandom has evolved, I do think the approach, and I think this is something that's for those of us who are like 40 or younger that are voters, you know, how we approach those who have incredible in-ring careers and their historical significance. I think, you know, that's something we need to step up and sort of, you know, start voting for those people that that really do deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, but maybe are not the main eventers and the pay-per-view stars or premium live event stars, I should say these days, you know. That's not to say by any means that we should dilute the caliber and the level of, you know, success that it takes to get into the Hall of Fame. But I think we need to sort of acknowledge the other elements of this business that make great wrestlers, beyond simply the number of butts they put in the seats, right? And I think Sabu would go a long way to sort of, you know, truly recognizing the different ways that people influence this business and change this business. All right. So once again, thank you so much, Ryan. Thank you to the listeners of The Ballot, and enjoy all the wrestling out there. Take care. Bye.
This has been a Count Out Podcast. Ring Post Radio is the only show hosted by Ryan Knightsey and Scotty Edwards that talks about the entire world of professional wrestling. With new episodes coming out every Sunday, there is absolutely no reason to not listen to real, honest wrestling opinions from two crazy maniacs. Have a hot boy summer and listen along to Ring Post Radio every Sunday on the Count Out Network.
Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.